to look at the words of the speech. You actually can't go outside the words of the speech. You're not.
Welcome to Clubhouse Radio, live from the Catskill Youth Clubhouse on 90.7 FM, WGXC, broadcasting Acre, Catskill, and Hudson. That song was... I'm sorry, what song was that, Lincoln?
It was Ooh Child by the Five Steppers, I think.
All right, thank you. Stay tuned for some more great music discussion and more. We're going to kick off our show after the local news and weather.
From the WGXC newsroom, this is the WGXC Daily News. I'm Philip Grant. Bernadette Hogan, Carl Campanelle, and Bruce Golding report in the New York Post that one of Governor Andrew Cuomo's top aides, Melissa DeRosa, apologized to other Democratic lawmakers on an audio recording about the state's handling of COVID-19 deaths in nursing homes. DeRosa said that in August, as President Donald Trump threatened a Department of Justice investigation, and I quote, "we froze," end quote, out of fear that the true numbers would, and I quote, "be used against us," end quote, by federal prosecutors. While some Republicans quickly went to, and I quote, "impeach Cuomo," end quote, after reading the story, it does not say much new. Since long before August, many Democrats and Republicans have criticized how the Cuomo administration seemed to manipulate the reporting of COVID-19 deaths between nursing homes and hospitals. DeRosa's audio admission does not address all that, saying instead, and I quote, "because then we were in a position where we weren't sure if what we were going to give to the Department of Justice or what we give to you guys, what we start saying, was going to be used against us, while we weren't sure if there was going to be an investigation," end quote. Cuomo's administration is known for rare apologies, and DeRosa offered one on the recording. She said, and I quote, "so we do apologize," end quote. She went on to say, and I quote, "I do understand the position that you were put in. I know that it is not fair. It was not our intention to put you in that political position with the Republicans," end quote. Last month, Attorney General Letitia James released a damning report estimating that the deaths of nursing home residents in hospitals would boost the total nursing home death tally by more than 50%. Health Commissioner Howard Zucker then released figures showing the total for New York COVID-19 nursing home deaths was 12,743 as of January 19th, up from 8,711 deaths New York officials previously acknowledged. And you can read more about that story in the New York Post. Natasha Vaughn and Aaliyah Snyder are reporting for Columbia Green Media. Former Hudson Police Commissioner and Chatham Police Chief Peter Volkman pleaded guilty February 11th to illegally collecting nearly $93,000 from the Village of Chatham and the state pension system. Volkman, 57, a resident of Stuyvesant, was arraigned on charges filed by the New York State Police following an investigation by the State Comptroller's Office, Columbia County District Attorney's Office, and the New York State Police. Volkman pleaded guilty to taking state and local pension funds in the amount of $74,222 and $18,607 from the village by falsifying mileage vouchers and other reimbursements. Chatham Mayor John Howe said the plea effectively terminates Volkman's tenure as an officer and as a chief of police. He must also pay restitution in the amount of $92,829. State Comptroller Thomas DiNapoli said in a statement, and I quote, "Instead of upholding the law, Volkman, the chief law enforcement officer of the village, defrauded the state's retirement system and his community," end quote. He went on to say taxpayers have the right to expect their public officials, including law enforcement officials, will act with honesty and integrity, end quote. Volkman was arraigned on various charges, including two counts of public corruption, second-degree corrupting of the government, and second-degree grand larceny. He pleaded guilty to one count of fourth-degree grand larceny and official misconduct. Columbia County Assistant District Attorney Ryan Carty said he was arraigned in Columbia County Court under Superior Court information. DiNapoli's office said Volkman was double-dipping the state pension system. Carty said, and I quote, "As a result of acts of omission, Mr. Volkman was able to steal $74,222 from the New York state pension system," end quote. According to DiNapoli, he hid public source income from 19 municipalities and school districts in excess of the statutory limit by funneling the earnings through a private business. Howe said financial irregularities involving Volkman came to light in a routine village review in February 2020. Volkman was placed on administrative leave from the Chatham Police Department last September after the village was served with a search warrant related to the investigation. The chief was suspended from all duties at that time. And you can read the full story at HudsonValley360.com. Nick Reisman is reporting for State of Politics. New York lawmakers this week introduced a bill intended to block state and local governments from providing resources or personnel to federal immigration enforcement officials. The measure would also bar the disclosure of information deemed sensitive to federal immigration officials as well. State Senator Julia Salazar said, and I quote, "We cannot allow for our state and local governments to be complicit in the systematic abuse that ICE inflicts on our communities, including preventing people from accessing essential services. This is why it's urgent that we pass New York for All, our legislation that will prohibit New York's local and state law enforcement agencies from conspiring with ICE," end quote. Lawmakers previously approved and Governor Andrew M. Cuomo signed into law a bill that bars federal immigration officers from courthouses in New York. The push to restrict the federal government's immigration enforcement efforts were heightened during President Donald Trump's term. But lawmakers, as well as advocates who support the measure, point to ongoing concerns and mistrust within the immigrant community. Read the full story at NewYorkStateOfPolitics.com. Amelia Teasdale is reporting for the Columbia paper. The Chatham Village Board voted unanimously in February in a February 8th online meeting to pass a local law eliminating the village court and the position of village judge. The court will remain open until early April when the term of the current judge, James Borgia Foster, expires. The village board held a public hearing on the local law before the board's regular meeting. One resident, Lyle Locke, a former village board member, asked why the board planned to close the court and whether it was for financial reasons. Mayor John Howe said the court was previously sustained by the revenues it brought in, but in recent years, court finances have been, and I quote, pretty much a wash, end quote. However, as of last year, and I quote, we were in the red, end quote. In 2020, the court was forced to shut down due to the pandemic, resulting in no revenue from court activity. In addition to the cost of the court, the mayor said the village paid two police officers to be at the court when cases were being heard. Tickets and other court issues in the village will now go to the town courts in Chatham and Ghent. Part of the village is located in the town of Chatham and part in the town of Ghent. Of the four villages in Columbia County, only Kinderhook and Philmont still have their own courts. And you can read the full story in the Columbia paper. And that wraps up the WGXC Daily News. For local weather reports, public meetings, community information, or COVID-19 updates, visit our website at WGXC.org. From the WGXC Newsroom, I'm Philip Graham. Have a good day and a nice weekend.
Hello and welcome to the better weather for Friday, February 12th. Brr, it is 1 degree in Hubble Corners.
Parties in this chamber must refrain from using language that is not conducive to civil discourse. The senator from Colorado, Senator Bennett, has a question for the House managers, and the clerk will read the question.
Since the November election, the Georgia Secretary of State, the Vice President, and other public officials withstood enormous pressure to uphold the lawful election of President Biden and the rule of law. What would have happened if these officials had bowed to the force President Trump exerted or the mob that attacked the Capitol?
Question from Democratic Senator Michael Bennett of Colorado. Question to the House impeachment managers, who are once again conferring with each other as to who and how they will respond. Again, we were told that we shouldn't anticipate this phase of the trial to go all 4 hours, but it could. That's what the 4 hours are there for. I suspect when the 4 hours are up, the trial will adjourn for today. Tomorrow, I suspect they will likely take up the issue over witnesses, then have closing arguments. Very possible that tomorrow this trial will finish, will be done. And if so, they could even potentially vote whether or not to convict the former president. It's unclear if there will be a period of time.
The House managers have 5 minutes.
It's unclear if they will have a period of time to actually make statements, the senators themselves, before voting on whether
to
convict.
I want to take a minute and remind everybody.
This is Joaquin Castro.
About the incredible pressure that Donald Trump was putting on election officials in different states in this country and the intimidation that he was issuing. I want to remind everyone of the background of Donald Trump's call to one Secretary of State, the Secretary of State from Georgia, Mr. Raffensperger. Donald Trump tried to overturn the election by any means necessary. He tried again and again to pressure and threaten election officials to overturn the election results. He pressured Michigan officials, calling them late at night and hosting them at the White House. He did the same thing with officials in Pennsylvania. He called into a local meeting of the Pennsylvania legislature, and he also hosted them at the White House, where he pressured them. And in Georgia, it was even worse. He sent tweet after tweet attacking the Secretary of State until Mr. Raffensperger got death threats to him and his family. His wife got a text that said, quote, "Your husband deserves facing a firing squad for doing his job." Mr. Raffensperger stood up to him. He told the world that elections are the bedrock of this society, and the votes were accurately counted for Donald Trump's opponent. Officials like Mr. Sterling warned Trump that if this continued, someone's going to get killed. But Donald Trump didn't stop. He escalated it even further. He made a personal call. You heard that call because it was recorded. The President of the United States told a Secretary of State that if he does not find votes, he will face criminal penalties. Please, senators, consider that for a second. The president putting all of this public and private pressure on election officials, telling them that they could face criminal penalties if they don't do what he wants. And not just any number of votes that he was looking for. Donald Trump was asking the Secretary of State to somehow find the exact number of votes Donald Trump lost the state by. Remember, President Biden won Georgia by 11,779 votes. In his own words, President Trump said, quote, "All I want to do is this. I just want to find 11,780 votes." He wanted the Secretary of State to somehow find the precise number plus one of votes that he needed to win. As a Congress and as a nation, we cannot be numb to this conduct. If we are, and if we don't set a precedent against it, more presidents will do this in the future. This will be a green light for them to engage in that kind of pressure and that kind of conduct. And this could have gone a very different way if those election officials had bowed to the intimidation and the pressure of the President of the United States. It would have meant that instead of the American people deciding this election, President Trump alone would have decided this American election. That's exactly what was at stake, and that's exactly what he was trying to do. He intended, wanted to, and tried to overturn the election by any means necessary. He tried everything else that he could to do to win. He started inciting the crowd, issuing tweet after tweet, issuing commands to stop the count, stop the steal, worked up the crowd, sent a save the date. So it wasn't just one speech or one thing. He was trying everything. He was pressuring elected officials. He was riling up his base, telling them the election had been stolen from them, that it had been stolen from him. It was a combination of things that only Donald Trump could have done. And for us to believe otherwise is to think that somehow a rabbit came out of a hat and this mob just showed up here on their own, all by themselves. This is dangerous, senators. And the future of our democracy truly rests in your hands.
Joaquin Castro, Mr. Democrat President, from Texas.
The senator from Texas.
Mr. President, I send a question to the desk.
This is a question from Republican Senator John Cornyn of Texas. John Cornyn is the second highest ranking Republican in the Senate. He is the Republican whip, which means it is his duty to whip his Republican caucus into line to vote for certain ways on bills.
The senator from Texas, Mr. Cornyn, has a question for both counsel for the former president and the House manager. The clerk will read the question, and the who recognized first the counsel for the former president.
The House managers have argued that if the Senate cannot convict former officers, then the Constitution creates a January exception, pursuant to which a president is free to act with impunity because he is not subject to impeachment, conviction, and removal and/or disqualification. But isn't a president subject to criminal prosecution after he leaves office for acts committed in office, even if those acts are committed in January?
This time we will hear from Bruce Castor of Trump's defense team, responding to a question from Republican Senator John Cornyn.
The senator from Texas's question raises a very, very important point. There is no such thing as a January exception to impeachment. There is only the text of the Constitution, which makes very clear that a former president is subject to criminal sanction after his presidency for any illegal acts he commits. There is no January exception to impeachment. There is simply a way we treat high crimes and misdemeanors allegedly committed by a president when he is in office, impeachment, and how we treat criminal behavior by a private citizen when they are not in office.
Bruce Castor.
The House managers.
In response will be Jim Grassman.
Thank you for this excellent question. Wouldn't a president who decides to commit his crimes in the last few weeks in office, like President Trump, by inciting an insurrection against the counting of Electoral College votes, be subject to criminal prosecution by the U.S. Attorney for the District of Columbia, for example, the Department of Justice? Well, of course, he would be. But that's true of the president, regardless of when he commits his offenses in office. In other words, that's an argument for prosecuting him if he tried to stage an insurrection against the union in his third year in office or his second year in office. You could say, well, he could be prosecuted afterwards. The reason that the framers gave Congress, the House, the power to impeach, the Senate, the power to try, convict, remove, and disqualify was to protect the Republic. It's not a vindictive power. I know a lot of people were very angry with Donald Trump about these terrible events that took place. We don't come here in anger, contrary to what you've heard today. We come here in the spirit of protecting our republic, and that's what it's all about. But their January exception would essentially invite presidents and other civil officers to run rampant in the last few weeks in office on the theory that the House and the Senate wouldn't be able to get it together in time, certainly according to their demands for months and months of investigation, wouldn't be able to get it together in time in order to vindicate the Constitution. That can't be right. That can't be right. We know that the peaceful transfer of power is always the most dangerous moment for democracies around the world. Talk to the diplomats. Talk to the historians. They will tell you that is a moment of danger. That's when you get the coups. That's when you get the insurrections. That's when you get the seditious plots. And you know what? You don't even have to read history for that. You don't even have to consult the framers. You don't even have to look around the world. It just happened to us. The moment when we were just going to collect the already certified electoral college votes from the states by the popular majorities within each state, except for Maine and Nebraska, which do it by congressional district as well as statewide. But otherwise, it's just the popular majorities in the states. And we were about to certify it, and we got hit by a violent insurrectionary mob. Don't take our word for it. Listen to the tapes. Unless they're going to claim those are fabricated too, and the people are yelling, this is our house now. And where are the blank votes at?
Time is up.
And show us the votes, et cetera. Thank you.
Jamie Raskin, the lead House Impeachment Manager. Now going to hear from Chuck Schumer, so we may be going into a dinner break.
Mr. President, it's my understanding there are no further questions on either side.
The Republican leader.
That's correct. I know of no further questions on our side.
I ask unanimous consent that the time for questions and answers be considered expired.
Without objection, so ordered.
Now, Mr. President, I ask unanimous consent that it be in order for myself and Senator McConnell to speak for up to 1 minute each, and then it be in order for me to make a unanimous consent to request as if in legislative session.
Without objection, so ordered. The senator from New York.
Thank you, Mr. President. And, Mr. President, in a moment, I will ask the Senate to pass legislation that would award Capitol Police Officer Eugene Goodman the Congressional Gold Medal. In the weeks after the attack on January the 6th, the world learned about the incredible, incredible bravery of Officer Goodman on that fateful day. Here in this trial, we saw a new video, powerful video, showing calmness under pressure, his courage in the line of duty, his foresight in the midst of chaos, and his willingness to make himself a target of the mob's rage so that others might reach safety. Officer Goodman is in the chamber tonight. Officer Goodman, thank you.
Standing ovation for Officer Goodwin. He was the police officer that led the mob away from some senators and towards a line of police in the Capitol.
Republican leader. Leader McConnell.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Okay. Oh. I just want to say I think we can all agree that Eugene Goodman deserves the highest honor Congress can bestow. But I just, before we moved to pass this legislation, I want to be clear that he was not alone that day. The nation saw and has now seen numerous examples of the heroic conduct of the Capitol Police, the Metropolitan Police, the SWAT teams that were with us on January 6th here in the Capitol protecting us. Our heartfelt gratitude extends to each and every one of them, particularly now as members of the force continue to bear scars, seen and unforeseen, from the events of that disgraceful day. Let us give them all the honor and recognition they so justly deserve.
Interestingly, Eugene Goodwin, the officer who's being honored here, has been serving security for this impeachment trial.
Mr. President.
The Republican leader.
Pleased to join the majority leader's request. January 6th was a day of fear for those who work here in the Capitol and of sadness for many more watching from afar. But that awful day also introduced our nation to a group of heroes whom we in Congress were already proud to call our colleagues and to whom we owe a great debt. In the face of lawlessness, the officers of the U.S. Capitol lived out the fullest sense of their oaths. If not for the quick thinking and bravery of Officer Eugene Goodman, in particular, people in this chamber may not have escaped that day unharmed. Officer Goodman's actions reflect a deep personal commitment to duty and brought even greater distinction upon all his brave brothers and sisters in uniform. So I'm proud the Senate is taking this step forward, recognizing his heroism with the highest honor we can bestow.
So, Mr. President, as if in legislative session, I ask unanimous consent that the Committee on Banking, Housing, and Urban Affairs be discharged from further consideration of S-35 and then at the Senate proceed to its immediate consideration.
Without objection. And the clerk will report.
S-35, a bill to award a Congressional Gold Medal to Officer Eugene Goodman.
Without objection, the committee is discharged, and the Senate now proceeds to the measure.
Mr. President, I ask unanimous consent that the Van Hollen substitute amendment, which is at the desk, be considered and agreed to, the bill as amended be considered read a third time and passed, and the motions to reconsider.
We felt very powerless and that we had no control over the situation. Sometimes the best thing we could do was just be at their bedside and talk them through mm-hmm. their pain and, you know, talk to their family members. And it was an extremely difficult experience. But it was, on the other hand, it was, you know, in ways inspiring to see all of my colleagues and all of the nurses, sacrificing so much to give so much of themselves to help these people, even though we knew we weren't doing all that much because we didn't know that much.
All right. I think we have time for one more question before we go to news, and then we'll come back with one more question.
Sure.
Have you been diagnosed with COVID yet or at all?
I actually had it very early in March. I got sick, and this was around the time there were a lot of cases. There were very few cases, and we didn't even have testing. So I had all the symptoms. I was quarantined from work for a period of days. My symptoms were very mild. I had a fever for a day, and I was tired for a day, and I actually did lose my sense of smell and my sense of taste, which is fairly common for this virus. And there was no testing at that time. And I got my antibodies tested like a month later, and I was positive. So even though I didn't have the PCR testing mm-hmm. that tests for the active virus, you know, I had all the symptoms, and my antibodies came back positive a month later. So I think so, but and I'm pretty sure, but, you know, I don't have the PCR test to prove it.
All right. So now we're going to go off with our local news and weather.
We will be right back.
From the WGXC newsroom, this is the WGXC News Update. I'm Philip Grant. The Times Union is reporting Governor Andrew M. Cuomo's Secretary Melissa DeRosa told state lawmakers in a conference call on February 10th that the administration's protracted refusal to release full data on COVID-19 deaths of nursing home residents was due to the belief that they were facing a politically motivated probe by former President Donald J. Trump's Justice Department. The disclosure prompted fresh demands from lawmakers in both parties for a full investigation of Cuomo's stonewalling and possible obstruction of a federal request, as well as calls from Republicans for the governor's resignation or impeachment. In the meeting, DeRosa explained why Cuomo's team rejected the legislature's request for the complete data a month after the state health department released a self-exonerating report concluding that Cuomo's March order that care facilities could not turn away COVID-positive residents did not play a significant role in the virus's devastating spread through many of those facilities. That report, however, only counted deaths of residents at the facilities and not the deaths of those who were shifted to hospitals and then died. In a statement February 12th, DeRosa said her comments were taken out of context. She said, and I quote, "We were comprehensive and transparent in our responses to the DOJ and then had to immediately focus our resources on the second wave and vaccine rollout. As I said on the call with legislators, we could not fulfill their request as quickly as anyone would have liked. but we are committed to being better partners going forward as we share the same goal of keeping New Yorkers as healthy as possible during the pandemic, end quote. But in the meeting, DeRosa made it clear that the administration viewed the federal inquiry as a political attack. DeRosa apologized to the lawmakers for the political pressure placed on them by the administration's refusal to provide the data. Republican State Senator Jim Tedesco said in a statement DeRosa's admission was shocking. And I quote, rather than apologize for the cover-up and any role the Cuomo administration may have played in the deaths of 15,000 New Yorkers from the coronavirus in nursing homes, Ms. DeRosa instead gave a mea culpa for putting the Democratic legislators in an inconvenient political position, end quote. Other critical comments were posted on social media from Democrats, including Assemblymember Uline New and State Senator Julia Salazar. Assemblymember John McDonnell issued a more conciliatory statement. He said, and I quote, I am committed to getting answers to the many outstanding questions and discerning the facts we need to make informed decisions on next steps. Anyone who lost a loved one in a nursing home deserves these answers, and my colleagues and I are committed to ensuring full transparency on this issue, end quote. Read the full story in the Times Union. Aaliyah Snyder is reporting for Columbia Green Media. The Galvin Foundation housing developments planned for North 7th Avenue and Upper State Street on Hudson's north side do not have on-site parking, leading to an ongoing conversation about where future residents will park. As a result, the foundation will conduct another Depot District parking assessment after criticism of its initial study, which cited the number of available parking spaces for one night only. Although the plans for the Depot District to minimize on-site parking is in accordance with the Hudson Comprehensive Plan, there is no on-site parking to be provided for 138 new units in the area, raising the question, where will everyone park? At a meeting of the City Planning Board this week, Dan Kent, Galvin Foundation Vice President of Initiatives, mentioned that renting spaces from the city's Columbia Street Municipal Lot and One Hudson City Center were possible options. The foundation hired Mark Nadalny of Crichton Manning Engineering LLP to conduct a traffic and parking study to assess where residents of the planned buildings would park. Galvin has now asked Crichton Manning Engineering to conduct a follow-up assessment based on feedback from the Planning Board and the Hudson Fire Department, Kent said. Kent wrote, and I quote, we are now in the process of identifying creative solutions for off-street parking, which include an assessment of available parking in the vicinity of the project site, end quote. The Planning Board agreed to begin the public hearing process March 9th. Kent said the results of the follow-up parking study and detailed parking recommendations will be completed in time for the hearing. And you can read the full story at HudsonValley360.com. State and local election officials are reminding voters that the party change deadline statewide is Sunday, February 14th, but because the 14th is a Sunday, the effective deadline is Friday, February 12th. Any voter that wants to change their party enrollment in time to vote in a 2021 primary or caucus must submit a change of enrollment form to the Board of Elections no later than close of business on the 12th. Note, if an enrollment change form is submitted at the DMV, it is not enough to submit that change form at the DMV by Friday. The change must be forwarded by the DMV and received at the Board of Elections by the 12th. The primary elections will be held on June 22nd, so an enrollment change received after the February deadline will become effective on June 29th, one week after the primary. Due to COVID-19 restrictions, the Columbia County Board of Elections asked that voters, and I quote, attempt to do election-related businesses by phone, mail, or email, end quote. The board can be reached by phone at 518-828-3115 or via email at elections@columbiacountyny.com. The Greene County Board of Elections can be reached at 518-719-3550 or via email at elections@discovergreen.com. And that wraps up the WGXC News Update. For local weather reports, public meetings, community information, or COVID-19 updates, visit our website at WGXC.org. From the WGXC Newsroom, I'm Philip Grant. Have a good day and a nice weekend.
Clubhouse, it's the fun house, it's the best house, bit of a mess house or stress house. We joke around or can be serious, so come here being versus or delirious. We don't make fun of, we don't bully, don't pull on the back a nobody hoodie. Accept everybody the way they are, just facts, cause every time we sign in we make a pact. Cause it's the clubhouse, it's the fun house, it's the best house, bit of a mess house, no stress house. We follow the rules, community guidelines too, so nobody here acting a fool. We got radio, we got tracks, then we hit the art room and relax. Now we about to hit a throwback. Don't hog that remote, Bubba. You better give me the remote. Give me the remote, Bubba. Cause it's the clubhouse, it's the fun house, it's the best house, bit of a mess house, no stress house. In this house make nobody feel inferior, cause anyone can have a great interior. Yo, we special, yo, we cool, so come on down and be a part of the clubhouse crew. I'm out.
That was an original clubhouse theme song by one of our clubhouse guests.
DJ AJ.
But welcome back to the Clubhouse Radio. All views expressed on Clubhouse Radio are our truth and may not represent the views and opinions of the Clubhouse Parent Organization and the Mental Health Association of Greene County. So on Skype we have a guest, Mr. Eric. So we have a few more questions for you.
Sure.
So, what impact did the speed of vaccines coming out have on safety?
That's a great question. I think it's, a concern that a lot of people have had. I think what people don't realize is that, you know, this vaccine technology, the mRNA vaccine technology, has actually been in development and has been researched for almost 20 years already. So the company BioNTech, who partnered with Pfizer to make their vaccine, they've been studying various different mRNA vaccines for a few years already, and Moderna, the other company that made the mRNA, the other mRNA vaccine that's available, has also been studying these vaccines for a few years. So, yes, they did come very fast, but the technology had been in development for about 10 to 20 years already. So they already had some information that these vaccines would be safe. Now, what about the vaccine for specifically coronavirus?
So the way
the mRNA vaccine works is it's basically like instructions that tell your cell to produce a protein. So when you get vaccinated with the mRNA vaccine, this molecule called mRNA is basically is instructions, like a script, for your cells to make proteins, which your cells do all the time continuously. And it tells your cells to make a protein that the virus expresses called the spike protein. Once your cells make the spike protein, it stimulates an immune response against that protein, which is how traditional vaccines work. So a lot of traditional vaccines are either they take the virus and they weaken it so it doesn't infect you, or they take a protein from the virus and inject it into you to stimulate an immune response, meaning it tells your white blood cells that are in charge of fighting off and recognizing things that don't belong in your body. It tells them this protein is foreign. It's an invader. If you ever see it again, attack whatever has this protein on it. So basically, you know, the vaccine that we have is two technologies that have sort of been around for a long time. Traditional vaccines have been around for hundreds of years, and the mRNA technology has been in research for 10 to 20 years. So it sort of combines the two concepts, two technologies that have been around for a while, and puts them into one vaccine. So, you know, the mRNA, this is the first mRNA vaccine to be approved. And I think, you know, people should definitely think critically about it and think, oh, this came very fast. Usually vaccines and medications take a long time to be developed. Why should this be safe? And it's something that, you know, in my opinion, it is safe based on a lot of what the data that's been published by these companies. They've studied it in tens of thousands of people, and they've studied it over the course of, albeit a short course, you know, 6 months at this point. They've been studying it, and there haven't been major side effects seen yet. And, you know, I think when you think about something like a vaccination, you have to weigh the risks and the benefits. You know, for me, and for what I tell my patients, it's, you know, I think the risk of getting a COVID vaccine, the infection far is much more of a concern for me, and I'm much more concerned about my patients getting the COVID infection than I am about a risk of some side effect from the vaccine, which hasn't been established yet.
Mm-hmm.
But it's a great question. I think it's a really important question, and it's something that you need to think critically about, speak with, you know, doctors about it. And I totally understand, you know, the sentiment that the general public has that this came very fast. But, you know, the reality is this is technology that's been researched and in development for many more years than people realize.
Do you have a favorite part about being a doctor?
Yeah, I like a lot of it, but, you know, hands down, you know, my favorite part is when you have a patient who comes to the hospital and they're very sick, and you find out what's wrong with them and you're able to treat it, and you get to see them go home to their family. For me, watching them leave the hospital healthy and in a much better state than they came in is, you know, one of the best experiences.
Mm-hmm. That's cool.
Dope.
Describe a time when you felt like a hero.
That's, you know, that's a difficult question, because, you know, you know, being a doctor, you know, being a resident, you know, it's your job. It's your job to take care of people. It's your job to treat sick people. So I don't oftentimes, you know, feel like, you know, I'm a hero, because, you know, this is what I've wanted to do my whole life. And it's honestly a privilege that I'm allowed to, you know, of course I'm allowed because I've trained and gone to school, but it's still a privilege that I get to work in a great hospital. I get to work with great doctors and great nurses and great staff, and I get to work with amazing patients. And you know, like I said, watching people leave the hospital is its own reward. But I will say I did have an experience recently now that I think about it. Mm-hmm. I had an older woman who came in during COVID, and she was very sick, and we were very worried she would have to go to the ICU, but she did well, and she got to leave the hospital. And months later, I got an email from a nurse from a different hospital saying she saw my name on a patient's chart and found my email and emailed me thanking me for taking great care of her mom. And for that to have come from a nurse who had also gone through so many hardships during COVID-19, that she appreciated what me and my team were able to do for her mom, was truly a special thing for me. And it was very emotional to get that thanks from her.
Yeah, that, like, my coach, her mother is very sick. That's what that reminds me of. Like, because she just got COVID a little while ago. Mm-hmm. And she actually did end up going somewhere, and, like, she was spending some time in the hospital, too. So that makes me think of that. Yeah, me too. She is getting better, actually.
That's great.
She's doing better.
Is that our last question?
No. Do you have a question?
Yeah. What's your experience of getting the COVID vaccine?
Sure. So I got it like the week it came out, because they were great in my hospital, and I think generally in New York City in the hospitals about getting it to their frontline workers very quickly. So I got mine almost 2 months now already. I'll be honest, after the first shot, I think because I had had a prior infection, the next day I had my arm was sore. And I felt a little bit tired, but that went away after about a day. And same thing with the second shot. My arm was a little sore, and I was a little tired the next day. But I always experience that when I get the flu shot, too. So it wasn't very different from the normal sort of vaccine symptoms I get when I get, like, a flu shot.
Mm-hmm. So do you know, like, other people that have had the vaccine, but, like, do you know, like, their experiences, like, how they felt during or after they've gotten the shot?
I do know some people who felt, you know, fatigued, very tired, maybe had some muscle aches, but I haven't heard from too many people that they had very, very severe symptoms or reactions to it. If you look at what's published about the vaccines, you know, there's a lot of people who experience, you know, muscle aches, fatigue, but it generally goes away after a day or two, and people, they can manage it by taking Tylenol or something.
Mm-hmm.
Most of the people I know who have gotten it have tolerated it pretty well.
All right. So how did you feel the first time you found out someone had COVID, like, in your office?
So, the crazy thing was I was only working in the hospital at this time because our clinics, you know, our office clinics, probably what you guys are used to when you go to the doctor, all of those were closed because, you know, the healthcare systems were so overwhelmed and there were so many hospitalized patients that we needed everybody in the hospitals. So the first patient I had with COVID, I was extremely nervous. I had no idea what to expect. And, the unfortunate thing about that time was there were just so many more patients coming in with COVID. So, you know, within my first day really treating it, you know, one went from one patient to nine patients. So it came really fast, and it was extremely overwhelming. And, you know, like I said earlier, I felt a lot of us felt, you know, powerless because we didn't know what we were dealing with. And, we were sort of watching a new disease present itself to us right before our eyes, and it was very scary. It was scary for us, and it was extremely scary for the patients and their families. Mm-hmm. And we all felt collectively scared and powerless, but you know, we had such faith in the scientific community and in the medical community that one day we'd have an answer and one day we'd have a vaccine. And I think knowing that so many people around the world were working so hard to come up with solutions and medications and treatments kept us going, and it really pushed us through.
All right. So I think that's about all the time. About all the time we have. But that was pretty decent because we got through quite a big chunk of all our questions.
Yeah.
So now we have time for shout-outs. But I just want to say thank you so much for being on the show today. You definitely
thank
helped out.
Thank you guys for having
much.
Me.
Mm-hmm.
You had a lot of very interesting answers to our questions.
Mm-hmm.
You guys answered great. You guys asked great questions. And I'm mm-hmm. glad I can hopefully give some information and share my experiences.
Mm-hmm. And I want to thank you for listening to our show last week also.
Yeah.
Okay. So
I think this is so cool what you guys are doing. I wish mm-hmm. I had this when I was in high school.
Thank you for listening. Catch us next week and every Friday at 6 p.m. on WGXC 90.7 FM and WGXC.org. If you are 12 to 18 and want to get involved in our programming or a radio show, come by the clubhouse Fridays 4 to 7, and your masks are clearly required. We will finish off with our shout-outs. Big thank you to Wave Farm and WGXC for making this radio program possible. The Catskill and Hudson Youth Clubhouses and the Mental Health Association of Columbia Green Counties for supporting this program. And thank you to Phoebes on Skype, and thank you to Dr. Eric for being a guest. And now we're going to end the show off with a song by Nina Simone called Feeling Good.
See you next week.
Birds flying high, you know how I feel. Sun in the sky, you know how I feel. Breeze drifting on by, you know how I feel. It's a new dawn, it's a new day. It's a new life for me, yeah. It's a new dawn, it's a new day. It's a new life for me. Ooh, 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 ooh. And I'm feeling good. Fish in the sea, you know how I feel. River running free, you know how I feel. Blossom on the tree, you know how I feel. It's a new dawn, it's a new day, it's a new life for me. And I'm feeling good. Dragonfly out in the sun, you know what I mean, don't you know? Butterflies all having fun, you know what I mean? Sleep in peace when day is done, that's what I mean. And this old world is a new world and a bold world for me. Stars, when you shine, you know how I feel. feel. Scent of the pine, you know how I feel. It's a new dawn, it's a new day, it's a new life.